Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
What the heck is happening in Afghanistan? I think we roughly know the history. First, Russia invaded there, and we funded the rebels, the Mujahideen, against Russia. But then we left them behind, and they turned into Al-Qaeda. They were angry. They turned into terrorists and Al-Qaeda. Obviously, we just had the 20th anniversary of the horrible 9/11, and that led to us invading Afghanistan. And at first, I think everybody thought, boy, that was quick. We just eliminated the Taliban within days, it seemed. But then what were we still doing there 20 years later? And almost every president since we invaded has sworn to pull us out of Afghanistan. Like, what happened? I don't really understand. Why did this get so messed up? And by the way, I don't think it's necessarily the president's fault. I don't know who's. I don't want to have blame. I just want to know what happened. How was the decision made, and why were citizens left behind? And then what's going to happen next? Why is China involved now? And what happened in Iraq? Did we win that war? Is that war over? Like, what is going on? And again, I keep up with things, but I think the information coming out of these places is so little because we're just sick of it as a topic. So I asked on Brandon Webb. You've known, he's been on the podcast before, former Navy SEAL, has been in and out of the Navy and the SEALs for a decade or more. He was in the first group of people that was deployed to Afghanistan. So he's an expert to talk about what this war is about. And now he runs a geopolitical military news service called SOFREP, S-O-F-R-E-P, that, you know, millions of people check out for their geopolitical news. So he's the expert on all of this, and he's been involved in other things he'll explain. So he talks to us about Afghanistan, Iraq, his involvement in all these things, and finally, what happened, why did it happen so poorly, and what will happen next. And as usual, this is divided up into parts one and two. Both parts are fascinating, and I learned so much. Without further ado, Brandon Webb. Brandon Webb on, and we were just talking about the fact that I'm not really growing a beard, I'm just not shaving. And Brandon says he trims his beard every 10 days, and then we started talking. This is before the podcast. Jay mentioned something about how I look more Jewish. I called him a Nazi, which is appropriate. And no, it's not appropriate. The Nazis were worse than Jay. barely. But and Brandon mentioned that in the Taliban, it's a sign of manhood. And I could personally attest that the little scruff I'm growing is not a sign of my manhood.
Well, I was gonna say also, remember when that Bo Bergdahl, the guy in Afghanistan years ago, went AWOL and they sent all these guys after to hunt him down. He left a note and just walked out of the camp, and then the Taliban captured him, and then they turned him back over totally clean shaven. But to them, like, Americans would think, oh, that's no big deal. But that was like an insult by them towards us. Like, here's the girly man back, because they shaved him like a woman. So
that is the funniest. Like, did they shave his pubic hair?
That I don't know that. I don't know if I want to know.
This is the funniest story. It's like I needed to take a goddamn shower, so I went missing in action just so I could get captured, because I knew they would give me clean hygiene before returning me over to the Americans. And then what was his punishment? It's like he in jail or anything?
I'd have to check. I think he went to Leavenworth. There was outrage in the military community because this guy essentially went AWOL and people died looking for him, like searching for him. So that was the rub with after the fact, that, you know, many guys doing their jobs lost their lives to kind of try and find this guy who ended up, they brokered a deal with the Taliban to turn him back over.
And so, I mean, I want to talk to you about Afghanistan in general. You've been in the Navy SEALs, you were deployed to the Persian Gulf, and you also have run you were 13 years in the Navy with 8 of them as a SEAL, but you've also run kind of this new service, SOFREP, which is like, how would you describe it? It's like a military geopolitical geostrategy news service, which a lot of people subscribe to and get their news about international events. What's really the truth about what's happening, as opposed to the press release regurgitated, you know, mainstream media. You get the inside dirt because you know people in the intelligence agencies, the SEALs, the Navy, the military. And so it's a great service to subscribe to, SOFREP.com. So I want to talk to you about Afghanistan. But my first question is on this guy. When he left the camp, where did he think he was going to go? Like, where can you go in Afghanistan that you could finally say, phew, at least I'm safe now?
Yeah, I think he honestly thought, and I'd have to go back and look at the letter. I'm sure we could Google it in 2 minutes, but he essentially said, I believe it was, he kind of lost, and this is a great topic because he had, I forget how many years ago this was, but he said, I've lost belief in the U.S. mission, and I'm out of here. Like, I'm going to go. I think he thought he would join up with the Taliban or something like that, which was got a little bit different reception.
Right. Like, there's a lot of things wrong with that, but maybe some things he was saying I don't know. Like, we don't know anything. And we're recording this 2 days after the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. We've all had horrible stories remembering that day, and a lot of people share them. And, you know, a lot of people enlisted in, you know, the military after that. I don't know. Did you enlist in the military after that?
No, I had joined in 93, then was a search and rescue swimmer, and then went to SEAL training in 97, and then spent my time in the SEAL team from 97 to 2006. Then I contracted with a government agency, an intelligence agency, went back to Iraq, in Kurdistan up in Sulmania, which is the capital of Kurdistan. But so had some experience seeing like what happened to Iraq after we pulled out, and just kind of the Kurdish dynamic in this whole Iraq picture. But I went to Afghanistan right after 9/11. So I was, at the time I was married, my wife was 8.5 months pregnant, and I saw the second plane at the towers in San Diego, which is where the West Coast SEAL teams are based, and said, okay, I'm going to go. I'm next out the door. So I'll be gone and probably going to miss the birth of my son. And Hunter was born November 30th, 2001, when I think I was in I just finished a mission up in the north, based out of Bagram Air Base. So
you got there, you were basically like in the first team landing in Afghanistan. And at the time, I remember, I mean, there's a lot of history and we can kind of go over it, but just like right there, the you know, 9/11 happened. We realized it was Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and they were based in Afghanistan, and the Taliban was basically supporting them and hiding them and enabling them. And it kind of was confusing, like, is the Taliban the same as Al-Qaeda? Is Al-Qaeda the same as the Taliban? Yeah. Like, I didn't know. Like, I think the average person didn't really understand. And so you were there, and from what I remember, it was, like, quick and dirty. Like, I remember just thinking that was pretty quick that we beat Afghanistan in a war. And then 20 yeah. years later, you know, we just finally pulled out. And even now it's like a mess. We're still attacking them. And I don't want to make a judgment on who made mistakes. Like, they all made mistakes, but, why did it feel to you when you were there that you were just like mopping up and that it was going to be over quick?
So the difference I would say when I was there and up until, so I was there in 2001 to I think February 2002, and we had gotten, I think we were there end of October, beginning of November, until February the next year. But the mission was very clear. It was just what you said, right? It was destroy the terrorist training camps, kill the bad guys, and hunt down bin Laden. And that was a simple mission. The rules of engagement were very simple. If you run into fighting age male, which is, I think they briefed us 15 years or older, you could engage the enemy in that. So the mission and the rules were very clear, but past 2003, that's when it kind of drifted into no man's land, where nobody seemed to realize what the hell we were still doing over there. And this big defense machine had stood up. And now we invade Iraq, right? And so it's like, what are we doing in Afghanistan? What's the purpose and what says that mission is accomplished in Afghanistan? And then we went to fight the war in Iraq. And then in the special operations world, the SEAL Team 6 got Afghanistan and Delta Force got Iraq. And they're the ones that actually ended up capturing Saddam Hussein. And then it just felt like we were drifting aimlessly. And I think I told the story last time on the show. I had this dinner. So now I'm out of the military, starting a business. And I went to this dinner. My law firm, Shepard Mullen, invited me to this defense dinner. And the former Air Force General Counsel, Mary Walker, was speaking at this dinner. A very sharp lady. And I was one of the first ones to ask a question. I said, look, Mary, this was 2010. And I said, Mary, like, I wanted your opinion. I have friends that are still serving in Afghanistan. Nobody seems to know what we're doing over there. The rules of engagement have gotten very blurry. I had friends going on ops. And imagine this, going on a mission in Afghanistan, like say a direct action mission to this compound that the Taliban, that maybe a Taliban warlord owned, and they hit the compound, shots fired, they come back because they have another mission to go on. And this is now like 3 a.m. and they want to get, there's another mission in an hour. So they're reloading bullets in the magazines, and NCIS is interrogating them. I'm like, okay, why did you do these shots on target? Because they're kind of like making sure that these guys are following the rules of warfare, and they're like getting interrogated before they even go out on a second op for the night. And so it's just like, you're trying to fight whatever, even if it's just the battle. These guys didn't know what the mission was, but and their hands are tied behind their backs. And there's this crazy rules of engagement that guys actually got in trouble in the military. So imagine trying to fight a war like that. Then I asked Mary, I explained all this to her, and I said, what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan? Like, what is the strategic purpose? You've been in DC or around, you know, the president's staff. And she said, I have no idea what we're doing there still in 2010. And this room full of defense executives from SAIC and L3 and Boeing, they were like shocked. to hear that she said that. And I was like, well, at least I appreciate your honesty.
I mean,
nobody seems to know.
Did she say a follow-up to that? Like, why does she have no idea? Like, why didn't she have any idea? Like, you would think that at the highest level, there would be at least a narrative of a plan.
That's the problem, that there was no plan. And that's when you drift aimlessly in any organization without a clear plan. It's just a disaster. And that's why you see this culmination of what happened with this, you know, abortion of a withdrawal, because we just really never had a plan, never really, never built a strong foundation culturally. And so, boom, the Taliban takes over, has more control of the country than they did when we invaded. And we pumped $2 trillion into the equation, $89 billion for the Afghan army, which most of that is equipment that we just kind of handed over the keys to the Taliban.
So let me ask about Mary's answer, the Air Force General Counsel. And This was kind of in the middle of the whole thing. So it's about 9 years after it started and 10 years ago. So it's like right in the middle when these questions were really being asked, probably for the first time. I mean, maybe they were asked earlier, but I kind of felt for myself I was asking them a lot then. And I will give the answer I think she would have given if there had been a plan, which is that, listen, if we just leave, the Taliban is just going to take over and Al-Qaeda is going to come back. We're trying to nation build, meaning let's leave this country economically more developed than it was when we got here with democracy as the rule of the land. And we believe that can happen. Whether she was right or wrong, who knows? But that, I feel like that was the plan and the justification. But maybe the problem is they didn't know how to do that. Like, how do you, there's a saying, you either trade bullets or money over borders. And somehow or other, they never really economically developed the country, even though it was a very secular, developed country, let's say, in the 60s and 70s before all these wars and battles happened.
Yeah, and I also, when I got out and lost my first startup, I went to work in the defense industry for L3 for a division called Linkabit, which Qualcomm spun out of. But we were all about communications. So I kind of had this view of the government acquisition inside, now outside, and running at the time, my side hustle was SoftRep, which I turned into a business. And we were covering SoftRep, looking at the incentive systems that were in place for these retired generals and admirals, that they're getting recruited heavily by these defense companies. Now they're in and they're talking to their buddies who are on active duty saying, hey, buy these new airplanes, this amount of Predator drones, they're selling all this equipment. And it becomes this like crazy cycle of incentives to like keep the war machine going, right? So I think that in part played heavily in just the politics of war what kept us there and the defense spending.
So let's talk about that for a second, because again, I'm totally naive. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower famously, towards the end of his term, or it might have been his final speech in his presidential term, he warned against the rising military industrial complex and how the military was having too much influence in government through lobbying and so on. And we've seen all these examples of, you know, bad behavior by congressmen because of military lobbyists. Is that true? Is that really what's happening? Like, the military is just whining and dining these guys, and so they're saying, sure, let's buy a bunch of, you know, this military equipment and have another year of war. Like, is that what's happening? Is it so blatant?
No, I don't think it's that as blatant, but it is that does happen, right? The courtship, the promise of, hey, when you're out, I'm gonna get you on the board of this big defense company. So these, like, you know, backroom deals happen for sure, because I've seen it firsthand. Now, there's very strict rules in place in government contracting to try and limit the amount of potential bad behavior. But, you know, these promises of jobs and these, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, and these big contracts, that stuff happens all the time. And I think it's a part of the problem. In all respect for Biden, I say, look, Biden wasn't like staying up late at night with little army men on the Afghan map trying to figure out what was happening. He's relying on these military experts, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to kind of tell him what do we do. So I put a lot of blame on the Afghan pullout on the top military brass.
And I want to get to that in a second, but I just want to understand the yeah. background a little more, which includes really you also sure. your decisions. You know, you've been in, so as far as I could tell now from what you said, you were in Afghanistan right then and, you know, doing the initial mop up and then, you know, staying through to whatever was next. Then you left for a while and you're at a law firm dealing with defense. Then somehow or other, I'm getting the order wrong, but I want to understand what you meant when you said you were contracted by an intelligence service to go to Iraq. There's a story no. there. You can't just say you were were you in the CIA or some other intelligence agency? And what does it mean to be contracted by? Like what happened?
So there are certain, so my order was deployed to Afghanistan 2001 to 2002, went to instructor duty to 2006, where I was ended up my last tour running the sniper program. Then I got out and contracted for one of the three letter agencies. I'm under NDA. I tried to, like, the stuff is so unclassified. I tried to request they allow me to say it, but I can't. So I can allude to it. And you can so
did you
kind of
join them or you were like a freelancer? Like what kind of tax return did you get?
No, I was total 1099. So they, so these agencies have programs where they contract out work with ex-special ops guys to kind of go overseas and work in a variety of different roles. So I ended up going to northern Iraq and seeing, you know, that side of the kind of intelligence collection.
What was your mission there?
Side of things. Our mission was to basically plan pickups and meetups with people that were giving information to different intelligence groups in the U.S.
What do you mean? Pickup? Oh, I like, see. So well, there would be someone who was like deep undercover. You'd figure out how to meet them and get the information back to the U.S. Or you'd figure out how to get the money or whatever it is they needed.
Or the person in that, in many cases.
Like, did you have to rescue anyone?
There was nobody was rescued. We did also deliver large amounts of cash to various individuals who had
why?
Like and they had regional influence and they were giving up, you know, who knows what information they were giving, but the U.S. government deemed it enough. In some cases, we were paying millions of dollars a month.
So there would be crazy. Some warlord in Kurdistan that was influential and he had Iran, Iraq, Russia, and us, and maybe Al-Qaeda all vying for his attention. And yeah. He was basically holding out for the most money. Like, what did they do with, I know this is a little off topic, what did they do with that money? Did they put it in a Swiss bank account and eventually retire? Or what happens to that money? No, I mean, they don't spend it. There's no like Macy's in Kurdistan.
Well, your guess is as good as mine, but in one particular case, this guy was a religious leader / warlord, had plenty of, you know, Toyota Hilux vehicles with guns and ammunition. So I assume it was a lot of like basically buying hired guns and equipment. But for sure, I mean, I'm probably squirreling the money away somewhere.
Did these guys ever retire and like just say, okay, I'm going to move now to a penthouse in New York. I've got $78 million left. And just like, if I meet somebody who's like really wealthy and they say, oh yeah, I grew up and spent my life in Kurdistan, should I assume he's like corrupt in some way?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Although I will say this, like Kurdistan is a very stable part of Iraq. Like it seems like a totally different country. You know, they govern themselves, they police themselves. It's when you go in the south, it's chaos. So I was fortunate enough to be in Kurdistan.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, I, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX is track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Well, Kurdistan, weren't they totally disrupted by, like, we were sort of holding it together because the other Iraqis didn't like the Kurds, or Turkey didn't like, nobody liked the Kurds. And when we pulled out of Iraq, weren't they in trouble? Like, didn't a lot of them die?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Like, twice the Kurds gave us their loyalty. And this is part of the bigger issue with the Afghanistan is that we're constantly saying, look, this time we're going to back you and you have our support. And then we kind of leave them hanging twice, you know, Gulf War I and now the second time in Iraq. And so, yeah, like a lot of good Kurdish people in the military, the intelligence community got left hanging by America. In a bad way, and in the same sense we did it in Afghanistan. And now the problem is, you know, when you look at especially the special operations in the Army, their whole thing is to win hearts and minds. You know, the Green Berets, they get trained in various different skills, one of them being construction, engineering. So their whole thing is to go into these remote villages, build goodwill, win hearts and minds. And how are we going to do that when America keeps breaking its promise? That's the big problem. And nobody seems to know. Like, I have friends like you globally through my Harvard Business School group, and they're like, what the hell are you guys doing in America? Like, you destabilized Iraq, you know, caused this refugee crisis into Europe. Now for some reason we decided to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya. I lost a best friend there, Glenn Doherty. For what reason? Like, Libya is still a failed state. So what strategic objective did that accomplish for America? Like, I just don't understand what the hell is going on with American foreign policy.
I don't know if I'm the only one naive, and like, I try to keep up with things, but I'm asking this question because I honestly don't know what happened in Iraq. Did we win or did we lose? Like, I feel like Iranians are now hanging out in Iraq planning against us, and that, you know, the leaders there don't really like us right now. Did we liberate them? What the hell is going on?
No, that's the problem. So we had I remember a friend told me that the invasion book to go into Iraq, like the brief book, was like this thick, and that the post Iraq book was like this thick, like tiny, thin. Like, we just didn't really have a plan for once we captured Saddam and he was executed. Again, nobody knew what the hell we were doing. And instead of going, you know what, you can make an argument we shouldn't have invaded, or we should have, or we shouldn't have, but we did. And, you know, okay, well then how do we pull out in a dignified way that doesn't destabilize the region? Because that's what happened. I mean, we pulled out and left this power vacuum. Iran, who already had a foothold and was funding the insurgency against the Americans, all of a sudden they're emboldened. They have massive control over the region and Iraq. And you see the rise of ISIS, civil war kicks off in Syria, and people that, and look, it's a complicated world. It's hard to keep track of everything. And I remember talking to my friends in New York, and they're like, oh yeah, this is so bad. Like, Syria, we need to go and help and liberate Syria. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you're fighting a proxy war with Russia, because Syria, Russia has a very strategic base in Syria, and Putin is not giving that up. So you'd essentially be fighting a proxy war against.
All right, well, here's
Russia
another dumb question.
Iran.
Here's another dumb question. Why do we give a shit? Like, why do we care about fighting a proxy war with Russia? Like, let's say Russia wants to own Syria. Like, all right, take it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. We shouldn't give a shit. I think that was what was so frustrating to me, seeing these politicians, like even John McCain, who I respect for his service as a POW, was saying, oh, we need to arm the rebels. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, those rebels are ISIS. Like, how could you not know that is what's going on? And it didn't work out so well for us when we armed the rebels in Afghanistan, when the Soviets in the 80s had occupied Afghanistan, because we armed basically and trained bin Laden. Like, he was one of the Mujahideen fighting the Soviets. And all of a sudden, because they had victory over Russia, and a lot of the Arab Mujahideen came from the Middle East, so they were already in Afghanistan. So then they set up this, like, these terror training camps, which was, again, back to our mission in 2001. You've got to wipe out these infrastructure, these two biggest camps. The one you saw on that Al-Qaeda recruiting video that was famous after 9/11, the guys doing the monkey bars and jumping over fire pits. That was Tarnak Farms 1. That was down in Kandahar in the south. And then we took out and did my unit at SEAL Team 3 did a big reconnaissance mission on the north near the Hindu Kush for Tarnak Farms 2, was another big training camp. But what the hell we were doing after 2002, 2003 in Afghanistan, I really don't know. And it gets crazy, because my friends, my peers who were still in were complaining, like, what, we don't know why we're here, what we're doing. And I heard, and I'll call it rumors, but we had a lot of sources coming to us now running soft reps saying, you guys need to report on this and that. But I heard strong rumors that special operations units were hitting targets, not for any strategic value other than they knew they had money and gold, and they were keeping the gold and money for themselves. Like, that's how crazy stuff was getting over there. I mean,
wait, you mean the special ops people were keeping the money and the gold, or so Americans?
Yeah. Americans, yeah.
And do they, I always wonder, like, how'd they bring gold back? Like, did they just take a plane and they had like a sack of gold on their back, or?
Well, we heard they were turning it into US dollars in Kabul. So,
okay,
but we never quite get enough evidence to prove it. But I mean, there was, I took personally a lot of heat in my own community standing up for a few big stories we've done on SOFRA around war crimes, and plus, you know, our cooperation with the New York Times. But this was at a time, you know, this is probably back in 2012, 13, 14. And that was a time in America, like, people didn't want to hear about their heroes doing really bad stuff. Like, they're just, even if you could Google war crimes in the New York Times and see there are a ton of material there, like very good investigative reporting. It just fell on deaf ears because nobody was ready to hear about it back then. I think America is ready now, especially with this Afghan pullout. And look, Vietnam, Afghanistan, you spend long enough time in some place and you're going to have this, like, nefarious stuff happen.
So Iraq, we basically left it, I don't even know, like, we basically left it and we pulled out, and all we accomplished in all those years was, I guess, we removed Saddam Hussein, but now Iran essentially de facto runs Iraq from maybe, yeah. I don't know. And we disturbed the whole balance of power there. Like, that's off limits for us at this point. Do we even have an embassy in Iraq?
I don't think so.
This is the context of understanding Afghanistan. So,
yeah. Well, you look at cause and effect, right? The reason Brexit got so much attention was because of this refugees pouring into the UK. And they're like, okay, we need, and the EU made this decision, right? We're going to take this refugees. Why were the refugees fleeing the Middle East and Syria? Because the US had left this power vacuum, pulling out of Iraq. So now, like, in European Union that was trending towards open borders, now closed borders, countries are putting up fences, and now you have this push for Brexit, which was largely, you know, fueled by this whole, oh, we can't take these terrorists into our country and harbor them. Like, who are these people? And so, like, we, in some ways, like, we caused this whole mess in Europe and kicked off Brexit by the sudden pullout and power vacuum we left in Iraq. So, and that's the thing, like, you need to really, from my perspective, we've had this schizophrenic foreign policy with no clear plan. And it's like, if Americans don't understand what the hell we're doing abroad and the war fighters in being deployed to places like Iraq and Afghanistan don't understand what we're doing there, that's a big problem, like in any organization.
Yeah. Right. And, so it sounds like they basically played a giant video game. Like, okay, we've got these, you know, strength units and equipment units, and now we're going to go find the gold. And that's it. That's all we're doing, is playing this real life video game. So I guess this brings us to Afghanistan. And so just to summarize my naiveness, it seems to me that Obama, Trump, Biden, and basically every candidate alongside them has basically said, we want to get out of Afghanistan. So why didn't it happen earlier? What happened now? Why was it extended? What's going on?
And so I'll tell your audience a great book that was written by a friend of mine, Jeremy Scahill, called Dirty Wars. Dirty Wars is a very honest look at both the Bush administration and the Obama administration and how hawkish Obama was. Like, Obama was the first president. I mean, just like the year he won the Nobel Peace Prize, he killed a 16-year-old American citizen who just happened to be the son of a suspected terrorist, Anwar al-Awlaki. Al-Awlaki, also an American citizen. They went to Yemen to visit the grandparents, and someone in Obama signed off on it. They drone strike the 16-year-old American citizen. So, you know, Jeremy wrote the first book that kind of put him on the stage, called Blackwater, right? It was about the whole military contracting machine that kind of got out of control in Iraq. But he wrote Dirty Wars, and he made some pretty strong assertions towards not just the Bush administration, but the Obama administration, and didn't get as big a fanfare as he did for publishing Blackwater. But Dirty Wars is an excellent book that, if people are wondering what the hell we've been doing the last 20 years, read Dirty Wars. I'd highly recommend it.
All right, I will. So Obama was saying he's going to pull out of there, but in fact, he increased troops, and you're saying he was hawkish. Yeah. And again, I'm not making a judgment about Obama. Like you said, he was. Yeah. He had tons of advisors. It's not like he was a foreign Afghanistan expert.
Well, that's when I look at the current makeup of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I see not a lot of strong leadership coming from that group. And I think a lot of dissenting voices in Afghanistan got pushed aside in the officer ranks. And then you end up with this, you know, what we had with the pullout. So I really take issue with the senior leadership in the military. That, who the hell, why didn't the group of them stand up 10, 15 years ago and say, look, there's no reason for us to be in Afghanistan. We are wearing out our troops. I have people I used to be friends with in SEAL teams. I don't even recognize these people anymore because they've been so traumatized by 15, 20 combat deployments. They're not even the same people. We even heard they're getting like experimental injections in their spine when they come back, just so they can like have a normal conversation at dinner with their families. Like these
wait,
guys.
Wait,
like,
what are they being injected with?
I can find out. I'll have to ask one of my friends, because we had a conversation a couple of years ago. He was telling me, yeah, they get this injection in the brainstem, and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, how is
it's like
that?
Is it like an anti-anxiety, like an extreme anti-anxiety thing or something?
I think it has something to do with anxiety and just to kind of relax them, because they're so wired so tight. I mean, look, anytime you put an animal or a person into a traumatic environment, whether it's rape, a car accident, it's going to change that person. And so these guys are completely over traumatized. Now,
are you over traumatized? You've been in and out of there a bunch of times. Like, what did you do?
Well, the thing is, when I deployed, it felt like we did have a purpose. And, you know, back to Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, if you have a lack of purpose, you're in big trouble. And I think what the reason I've transitioned, and look, I've had my struggles. I really struggled with losing my friend Glenn Doherty in Benghazi, Libya, who was contracted for the CIA. And we can get into that whole story, which is a nightmare. Because the CIA originally didn't pay out his life insurance policy, and his friends and I had to pay for his burial, so his mom didn't have to pay the bills.
Why didn't they pay his life insurance policy?
There was a small disclaimer at the bottom of the policy that said if he didn't have a spouse or dependents, that the policy would never pay out. So it was like this little fine print. When his family and some of our friends went to the CIA with Director Brennan, they called the family into the office and pointed out the small, you know, oh, this is why this, you know, the insurance is not paid out. So they're like, wait a minute, you're mandating that these guys pay for a policy that you know will never pay out. They said, we don't care what's in the contract, what we care about what's right. So the good thing that came out of the whole Glenn Doherty issue was that the family basically shamed the CIA to back pay over, I think, 300 families back until the 80s when we had that embassy bombing in Beirut, killed all these Marines and contractors. But there was like 300 families that were in a similar situation, and they all, I think, got paid $500,000. So there's a lot of good that did come out of it, and the CIA, to their credit, ended up doing the right thing in the end. But I felt like I transitioned back into society because I had a sense of purpose behind my deployment. We did terrible things. Like, war is not like what you see in the movies. We dropped bombs on bad guys who had their families with them. And I remember first time we dropped a couple thousand pound JDAMs, you could hear babies crying in the background. Like, it was intense. And I wrote about that in the Red Circle, if you remember the first chapter.
Yeah.
But I think I adjusted because I had a sense of purpose. The problem with a lot of these returning veterans who are now transitioned out of the military is they don't have a sense of purpose. They're like, why the hell was I in Afghanistan? Why did my friend die? Why did I do these things? What was it all for? And now you have this massive increase in veteran suicide, and then frustration with the Department of Veteran Affairs, which does a terrible job. There are great people that care greatly in that work for the VA, but the bureaucracy, we did a story on Safra a few weeks ago that says that your chances of committing suicide go up 15 percentage points if you enter the VA healthcare system. So they're actually doing more harm than good.
So what's going on? So we decided to get out of Afghanistan a decade or so ago. Why didn't it happen immediately? What needed to happen for it to happen? And why did it happen now? And why did it go wrong? So Brandon set the stage. What was he doing there? How did all this start? What happened in Iraq? What was he doing in Iraq as a quote-unquote contracted intelligence professional? And now in part two, which was also released today, he describes what exactly happened in this pullout of Afghanistan. Why did it go so wrong? Why were civilians left behind? And what will happen next? And why is China involved? And a bunch of other things too. So listen to part two. It's out today as well. We're releasing these part one and part two on the same day. So go for it.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.